Welcome to Crosstalk. My name is Irene. I'm coming to you from South Florida, and I'm here with Dr. Barry Ryman. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and tell us how we're doing. We appreciate your comments. We are a nonprofit organization, and our goal is to raise money to get people the help they need. So please support us and share. So Dr. Barry Ryman, thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited to have you and to hear your full story. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, let's get started. So what we do here on Crosstalk is we, go through your story, tell me how it all began, where it began, what happened, and what it's like, what early recovery was like, and then what it's like living now. So go. Let's get started.
All right. I mean, I think that my story, I don't want to say it's unique, but it's not your run-of-the-mill, ripped and roared for many years, hit a bottom, surrendered, got it, right? It was, I like to get high, right? There's a few schools of thought out there when you're trying to quote unquote convince somebody to stop doing what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. And most people try to make it like you don't enjoy this anymore. It's no longer fun. It doesn't work anymore. So you should just stop because it's going to kill you. Instead of it feels good to feel good.
Right.
However, the way you're choosing to feel good will eventually make you feel worse. So if you want to break that cycle, the way you're choosing to feel good needs to change.
Yeah, that makes,
does that make sense?
That does now. If you told me that years ago, I probably would have been like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, most people are like, you can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
If you fucking tell me I can't do something, it makes me want to do it more.
Right. I feel that way too, a lot.
Right. So I had to, in my helping profession that I'm now in, come up with a way to make people feel like it's their own idea to get better.
So tell me, how did it all, where did it begin? How did it all begin? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Florida. I'm a native, okay. Which is weird, right? You don't meet too many Floridians, but I was born in Miami. I come from a good family. I don't come from that crazy story of having a broken home and being in foster care or living in different houses, multiple states. My parents, who are still alive at, my mother is 78, 79. My dad is 81, 80. He's 80. They've been married 58 years, still married. I always like to say that they probably should have been divorced.
Right.
30-something years ago. Yeah. The train of thought back then was you stay together for the kids. Because that's the best thing. It turns out it wasn't.
My parents are the same. Yeah, they're still together. They've been through it all. I have to say, it's pretty incredible to have watched. I admire them a lot for sticking together and working through some of those crazy
times. Yeah, you do it. Now they're okay, right? Yeah. Like they've grown together.
Right. Yeah.
but like I remember, I think I've shared with you before off camera that, my dad is from Argentina. So he's from another country, and my mother used to tell me when I talked about my dad's upbringing is that he wasn't brought up, he was dragged up. Right. He didn't have the best example as parents. So he carried that with him into being my father and how he did stuff and when it came to emotions. And my mom was or has been the polar opposite. She's an overbearing, in-your-face, emotional, codependent Jewish mother from Brooklyn, right? And my father was a very distant, don't show your feelings, but a provider.
Right.
And so there was, I would say, some type of balance between the two but I didn't grow up feeling like I can go to my parents and talk to them about anything. There was always consequences, right? Back then, they called it punishment. Today, it's called abuse.
Right.
If we're getting real.
Yeah.
Talking belts and, you know, all that good stuff. And then I have a sister who's 5 years older, who was like the perfect child. Okay? Just anything she touched turned to gold, you know, held in high regard, always excelled in school, top of her class, valedictorian, on the podium at the University of Florida, talking thousands of graduates, and her face is in the commencement book.
Wow.
Okay, sitting up on the stage, right? She's now a partner in a law firm, a very prestigious firm, for the past 25 years, maybe more.
Wow,
time
amazing.
Flies. And then there was me, who was the rebellious, I think they call it a black sheep. I once heard in a meeting that I was often referred to as a black sheep, and then after coming to NA or AA, I finally found my herd.
Right.
There's some common themes among us black sheep, which I'm sure you can relate to. But, you know, I took the path of least resistance, of how much fun I could have, no regard to society or rules, and I kind of really was the guy who beat to his own drummer. I picked up a substance for the first time. I must have been about 12 or 13. It was weed, and kind of fell into the wrong crowd. I was a skateboarder and really loved the lifestyle of just kind of escaping. And I can think back to, like, we look at addiction as a whole, and we know that it's a disease based on behaviors,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I look back to what my life was like before I even picked up, and I feel like there's telltale signs to what I would call budding addicts,
right?
Right? They talk about budding serial killers, that, you know, that I'm a psychologist, so you can, there's warning signs for sociopaths and serial killers, right? Fire setting, bedwetting, cruelty to animals. I feel like with addiction, you can pick up on some of the telltale signs way before somebody picks up a substance. So having done some work in my recovery and looking back and doing something like a 4-step, I've been able to pick up on some of those patterns that started way before I actually picked up a substance, with the lying,
right?
Right? Some of the mindset I carried with me. I was like a budding drug dealer. Okay, I remember being in elementary school, and we made these things called, people were selling them, these cinnamon toothpicks. I don't know if this was a thing when you were a kid, but
yeah,
like,
I sold candy, actually.
Okay, so I'm going to get there too.
Okay.
This is all in the same area, right? And it's so funny that you said that, because I'm going to tell you the story. But so they had these cinnamon toothpicks, and you would take these toothpicks and you would soak them in cinnamon oil for 24 hours overnight. And the next day you could sell them for 10 or 15 cents each one. I took my shit to another level. I did a 3-day soak.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And I would sell them for a quarter, right? But they were like the extra strength cinnamon toothpick. I must have been in third or fourth grade.
And that's the same years that I used to sell candy.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Then I would stop at Ecker Drugs. Remember Ecker Drugs?
Yeah, I remember.
And I would buy a big bag of Blow Pops, and I would dump them all in my knapsack, and I would sell each Blow Pop for a quarter. And when I got home at the end of the day, I had way more money than I started with. Fast forward to when I sold drugs, I'd buy a big bag of this, I'd break it up, throw it in my knapsack, sell it for this, and have a lot more money than I started, until I started becoming my best customer. So you look back at some of the behaviors well before. I remember, and I'll share this story, when I was in kindergarten, we didn't have report cards. We would get something called a happygram.
Okay.
And if you took your nap at the end of the day, you would get a little smiley face stamped on your happygram. Remember those blue?
I need one of those now. I'd like a nap.
Those blue mats they used to make you sleep on?
Yeah, yeah.
Your face would stick to it when you woke up. Well,
I feel like I never could fall asleep, you know?
Sweet.
Now, give me a blue mat any day of the week. Like, let me take a nap.
I must have had a really bad week, because my happy gram became a sad gram.
Oh, no.
And every Friday, we would have to take our happy grams home. They didn't have computers and email back then. We're talking, what was I, 5 years old? 1980.
Right.
Okay. So at 5 years old, I took my Happy Gram and I ripped it into a few pieces and I tossed it into the schoolyard. And I get home, and it's before I could even walk in the door, right? Because we walked home from school at 5 years old back then. And that's what we did. And I had friends, and my mom answered the door. And right, it wasn't like, "Hi, Barry. How was your day? Happy Friday." It was, "Where's your Happy Gram?"
It's that doom question.
And I said, "I don't know. I didn't get it." "What do you mean you didn't get it? You get it. I don't know what happened." And then she said the magic words, "Wait till your father gets home."
Oh, I hated that.
So I did. I waited until Dad got home. "Where's your Happy Gram?" "I don't know. I don't know." So we had plans that night. We were going to go to dinner at a place called Wags. I'll never forget this night as long as I shall live. And it was going to be the four of us, me and my sister, who I then referred to as Inspector Gadget after this incident. And my mom and dad, and we were going to go to Wags, and then we were going to go to this carnival that they had at like one of the churches, you know, like a local.
Uh-huh.
So we're at dinner, and Inspector Gadget says, "Why don't we go to the schoolyard to see if we can find it?"
Oh, she's a narc.
Yeah. My 5 year old, 5 years older than me. She was in fifth grade. I was in kindergarten. So we went. And Inspector Gadget pieced every piece of my sad gram back together.
Oh, no.
And Eileen, who's my sister, and my mother went to the carnival, and I went home with Dad.
Ugh.
And I had to pick out the belt from the closet, and then he used to make me smell the belt.
Wow.
And then he used to make me take my pants down, and he would whip my ass with the belt. And as he was whipping me with the belt, he would say in Spanish, "If you would only tell the truth, I wouldn't have to do this."
And did you speak Spanish as a child?
I understand it fluently because of that. He would speak to me in Spanish. I would talk back in English.
Okay, got it. Wow, that is a painful memory, though, like if you break it down.
But I learned at a young age, damned if I do, damned if I don't. Because if I would have come home and said, "Hey, guys, I ripped up my Happy Gram and threw it away," I would have got beat with the belt. So if I told the truth, I get beat. So I learned at a young age to lie. Mm-hmm. Red flag number one, right? Mm-hmm. It's those behaviors. Think about what we carry through our lives, right? I'm going to fast forward now because I'll forget to come back to this, but I'm going to fast forward to many, many, many years later. I'm already in recovery. This goes back to my mother saying my dad was dragged up and not brought up, right? And I was doing some pretty intense therapy. I must have had like 2 years clean or 3 years clean. I'm now 22 or 23 years old. My relationship had started to improve with my father after I got clean. And she gave me this assignment. And she said that, "I want you to ask your father why he used to make you smell the belt." Because I have to go pick out the belt.
Yeah.
And then before, he would make me smell it. He would put it up to my
nose. Yeah, yeah.
And I was lost on this, okay? Thought it was some kind of scare technique or I don't know. So we're at like a family gathering. I was smoking cigarettes at the time. My dad was too. This was before his quintuple bypass operation.
Wow.
And so we go outside and we're smoking a cigarette. And I say, "Hey, Dad," I said, "do you remember when I was younger, you used to beat me with a belt?" He was like, Oh, yeah. I said, "And you know, you'd make me go get it from the closet." He was like, "Yeah." And I said, "You used to make me smell the belt. Do you remember that?" And he says, "Yeah, I remember that." I go, "Do you mind if I ask you why?"
Right.
Like, why did I have to? And he said the most profound thing. And it was in that moment I forgave him. He said, "Because that's what my father used to do to me." And it was in that moment that that anger, resentment, those feelings melted away. And I went back in my head to what my mom had always told me, that he was dragged up and not brought up.
Mm.
That he was doing what was done to him.
Right.
And never in a million years did that enter into my conscience. You know, like I never thought like that's why he did that stuff.
Right. He doesn't that's know any better.
Who he was, right? Mm-hmm. And it brought me to the place of how powerful recovery really is. Leave the substance out, right? Why do people enter into recovery? When they're working a recovery program, it's not about stopping the substance. Right. That's stopped already.
Right.
Now what?
Right.
It's always about now what. And I have, as a 49-year-old man in 12 days from now, or 10, I don't know what today's date is.
August 2nd. It's my friend's birthday. Okay. That's how I know.
The 13th. I'll be 49. I've never, ever hit my kids with a belt, never made them smell a belt. That recovery really is about breaking cycles.
Absolutely. It's beautiful to break a cycle.
It's not what I signed up for.
Well,
okay.
You can't think that when I got intervened on,
I'm just saying, like, this is not what I signed up for. It is the path that has led me to this place that not only impacts me, but the choices that I've made in making the choice, and it is a choice,
right,
of getting better, impacts generations if you stick with it.
Yeah.
My kids are not dragged up. They're brought up.
Right.
You understand? So
that's really incredible. And it's so important I think this is the first time I've had this type of conversation on the podcast where, like, we talk about the fact that it is about breaking cycles, right? And it's about, like, not passing on this disease or the behaviors of the disease to the next generation.
So you can only do so much.
Right. Well, of course.
You can only do so much in the sense of with your own kids.
Right.
Right? And I worry. I have two girls that are 12 and 10. And when my kid was 8, my oldest was 8, she said to me, "Daddy, when I turn 21, I'm going to try alcohol." I said, "Really, Lily?" She says, "Yep, when I turn 21, I'm going to try alcohol." I said, "Okay." And she goes, "If I don't like it, I won't do it anymore." I said, "That's cool." She goes, "If I like it, I'll just do it in moderation, like every once in a while." I said, "That's fair." And she says, "But if it gets out of control, I'll just call you."
Yeah, and she's 8.
She was 8 at the time.
Yeah.
This happened during COVID. At the same time, I would have them at NA meetings with me. I remember it was like a beach meeting because it was outside during the pandemic. And she spent 30 minutes behind the meeting spinning in circles. I'm like, after the meeting, I'm like, "What were you doing?" She goes, "I don't know. It just felt good."
Oh, no.
Warning signs.
Oh, no, no. Well, it'll be a blessing if she waits till she's 21. Although I have some bad news is that I didn't get really bad till 26. So
I have some worse
There's
news.
No hope.
I got clean before my 21st birthday.
That's crazy. So let's go back to... I've asked you before and you just answered my question. Like, have you spoken to your kids about the fact that this is, you know, a genetic disease?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they know, their mom is also in long-term recovery. Mm-hmm. So, they're well aware that mommy and daddy don't drink, mommy and daddy don't do drugs. And there's a reason behind that.
Okay.
Okay. And then they tell their friends.
I love that.
They tell their friends.
So now tell me more about just how, you know, it all evolved for you growing up, you know, maybe not from kindergarten, the happy Graham, sad Graham, but what happened after that?
I got into drugs. I got into drugs at a young age. Not on purpose. I was just kind of hanging with the crowd and probably 12 or 13, started smoking some weed. I mentioned before I was a skateboarder and kind of the crowd I was running in started smoking cigarettes around the same time. You know, picking butts out of the ashtrays at Publix and, you know, stealing, you know, doing some things I shouldn't have been doing at that age. And then I got it together a little bit after my first year in high school, decided I wanted to go to college, did well enough to get into the University of Florida in Gainesville, went away to school at the age of 17, and that's where my addiction really took off. And all those things I swore I would never do with people I shouldn't have been with, going places I shouldn't have gone, I did all of them.
Right.
I was a nice Jewish boy from Plantation, Florida, that was smoking crack in the ghetto in Gainesville, and using my rent money and all my roommates' rent money to buy said crack. Got into selling cocaine and trafficking cocaine, large amounts, putting myself in some pretty precarious situations and not thinking. I had friends who I used with, right? There were always those friends who would get high with you, but you were just on a different level.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I've shared with you before, but there was one night when I was 19 years old and I was away at school, and my buddy Mike had invited me to go out to dinner, and I pulled up to his house and he kind of gave me the, come on in, 5 minutes. He was like, he was still getting dressed.
Yeah.
And so I parked and I went inside, and 20 of my closest friends were sitting in there. There was one empty spot on the couch. I'll never forget this night. A dozen Krispy Kreme donuts and a large coffee.
At least you got donuts. I'm like mad right now at my people for not
Krispy Kreme is the shit.
Yeah. So,
I sat down. It was like either 8:04 or 8:06 p.m. on the cable box. This was
You remember every day.
I remember. This was 1995. And it was an intervention. And they all went around the room and they shared about the person they had first met that first came up to school 2 years before that. And then they shared about the person I had become and the things I was doing. And they told me that I had to seek help. And they had a few things planned for me. One was, and I've shared this with you before, but they called them NAH meetings.
I love this. This makes me laugh so hard, the NAH meetings.
NAH meetings.
Yeah.
They were really NA meetings, but they were NAH meetings. Right. Or they had me going to this intensive outpatient counseling at Tigert Hall, which was on campus. And they made me sign this paper. And they said that if I choose not to do this, they would get my parents involved.
I'm pretty impressed at your 19-year-old friends at that time in life, right? You're in the 90s. I'm assuming like mid-90s.
This is 95, yeah.
Yeah. Having an intervention for you and not involving parents or a professional, you know, all 19-year-old guys. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Men and women.
Yeah.
I could tell you, looking back on the crowd that was in there, the majority of that room is uber successful today.
Incredible. Okay.
Two of those people, one of those people is a circuit court judge here in Broward County now.
Amazing.
Okay.
Who? And are any of them in recovery? Just out of curiosity.
No.
Oh, okay. So they were all just like recreational
coke doers, you know, ecstasy. And
I know people who can do that. And yeah. I'm amazed by it when I speak to some friends and they're like, yeah, I'm going to Berlin for the weekend. And I'm like, good for you. You know, good for you that you can go back on Monday. Like, I just could never return from, you know, I haven't been to Berlin, but like, I can never return from Berlin, so to say.
So they have me sign this paper stating that I would stop using and I would go to this counseling or these NAH meetings, and then they wouldn't tell my parents. So I sign away, you know, at this point it's after midnight, it's 4 hours of this. Okay. But I realize that in my pocket, I have this really fat bag of Primo, what we used to call Crippy. Crippy was like the dank weed. So this is back
like
in 95.
What I would call Kush.
Dank.
Yeah.
No seeds, you know, wet crystals on it, stinks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say to them, I'm like, look, guys, I said, I really appreciate what you guys have done for me here. Like, it's so appreciated. You have no idea. but I have this really big bag of weed, and I was thinking, since I've already used today, right? It's 8 o'clock at night. Yeah. It's now midnight. Why don't we all just, I'll smoke everybody out. We'll all use my bag, and we can start tomorrow. So the meeting of the minds takes place. They all go in the other room. They leave me alone on the couch with, now there's 6 donuts and not 12. Coffee's gone. And after like 5 or 10 minutes, they come out and they're like, okay, but tomorrow we're going to start.
I love it. Oh my God.
So the thought was there.
Right.
I think
it's like that starting the diet on Monday thing, yeah. You know, same thing.
So I think I lasted 24, 36 hours after that. Until like it was 24, 36 hours that I hadn't slept. So I was on benzos and I was on, you know, there was a lot of stuff I was taking. It really wasn't safe for me to just quit. I didn't know about things like detox back then.
Right.
Long story short, I wind up leaving Gainesville a few months later for good. I had to come home. I told my parents about, you know, what was going on. They threw me again into an IOP program. An intensive outpatient program. I still continued to do the wrong thing. I was going to GNC and buying this stuff called Puri Blend Tea that you would take for drug testing, and you'd have to drink a gallon of it.
Ugh.
And it was working until I got cocky and I was smoking like an hour before my drug test. And another story where I was working at a summer camp. I was home with all my friends, and I was a counselor, senior counselor, and I was literally doing the wrong thing. I was selling drugs to the counselors at the camp, not the campers,
right?
To the counselors. Wow. And I wound up getting busted, and they very easily, Nancy Bowen was the camp director, she very easily obviously could have called the police and had me arrested. Instead, she did something worse. She called my father.
Ugh.
And I walked into the camp office, and my father was in there with his legs crossed and his arms.
And even in your early 20s, I'm sure that's like the worst feeling.
She was holding pills in one of those little sample cups you get at a restaurant, shaking them.
Yeah.
I knew I was fucked. So, and even then, I didn't stop, right? I just faked it till I made it. And wound up re-enrolling in school down here and took 6-8 classes, dropped 6 of them, failed the other 2. Like, life was not going good.
Mm.
And then at 20 years old, 2 months before my 21st birthday, I was on a major run. I was living out of my house. I was living in an apartment in a place called Inverary. Very nice area of South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seeing this doctor. His name was Dr. Rick Harris. He was my psychologist that I got placed to see when I was 19, right after all this stuff went on with the camp and the outpatient.
Right,
and
right.
I had an appointment to go see him. This was Wednesday, June 19th, 1996. And I show up to my appointment, and sitting in the waiting room was Inspector Gadget, my mother, and my father. So my whole family.
Right.
Sitting in the waiting room. And I said, what is this? It was Krispy Kreme all over again, no Krispy Kreme.
My and style of intervention.
We went into Dr. Harris's office, and they did the intervention on me. And that night, I got tossed into a detox facility. It was June 19th, 1996, and I got intervened on by my family. Enough was enough, okay? There's many stories I can tell you about me stealing from my family and my dad marking $100 bills that he would keep in his closet that I was going in there and peeling off. It was really bad stuff, seizures and hospitalizations the night before Thanksgiving. And, you know, things were not going good.
I fell into a bowl of Chinese food on Christmas Day.
Oh, how appropriate.
Yeah, it was good.
Well, at this point, I'm 6'3" tall. I'm 140 pounds soaking wet.
That is so, that's scary.
Scary.
That's scary.
I get put into this detox facility. I land there at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I did not go in with the mindset of, today's a great day to stop and I want to give up my best friend for life, which was my substance.
Wait, I just have one question. So at this time, are you doing opiates?
Not really.
I wasn't an opiates person.
They didn't even, there was no such thing as OxyContin in 1996.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Were there the pill mills? Because I know we're in South Florida where the pill mills were
not
like
yet.
Every
not
corner.
Yet. We're talking now. I have 28 years clean.
Incredible.
Okay.
Incredible.
And June was 28 years.
Yeah, that's amazing.
There was no such thing as OxyContin back then.
Yeah.
Okay. There, I did Dilaudid.
Right.
And I did morphine. Those were some memorable nights that were not so memorable. Right. But yeah. My substance was really more. Whatever was in front of me.
More. Me too.
Crack cocaine, meth, cocaine, lots and lots of benzos, Xanax, Valium, roofies. Which were big back then. They were like the Quaaludes.
I don't know what roofies are.
Rohypnol. It was like flunitrazepam. It was like the Quaaludes.
Yeah. Okay. I was like uppers. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But
either way.
You're in detox. You don't want to get
rid of
your best friends.
I'm in detox. I didn't go in there with the mindset of, yes, I've hit a bottom. I cannot wait to get better. I'm completely done.
Right.
That's... I went in there with the mindset of, if I don't do this, I'm going to be disowned. So I made a decision, to give it 90 days.
Okay.
90 days. Not 90 days of treatment, just 90 days in general. For 90 straight days.
Were you going to go to these NAH meetings?
I was going to go to these NAH meetings. I was doing detox and treatment, and I was going to give it 90 days. And after 90 days, if I don't look better... If I don't feel better, if my relationships haven't improved, drugs will always be there. We're not going to go through prohibition again. That I owe it to myself, to my family, who's been through hell with me, to Inspector Gadget, 90 straight days, and on the 91st day, I'd reevaluate. I went into detox. I heard some crazy stories of these alcoholics. I was in there with a cardiologist who rewired his windshield wipers. Okay, listen to this shit. Put alcohol where his wiper fluid would go, and then rewired the clear hose that was supposed to go into his wipers into his door frame inside the car, and he would pull it out and do this with the wipers.
Stop it.
I swear to God, I'm not making this up. Like, how would I make that up?
I don't know how
it's
you would make
ingenious.
That up. That is incredible.
But he took Savage to a whole nother level as an alcoholic, okay?
Oh my God.
Talk about like... drinking and driving. That's the only place you can drink is if you're driving.
Oh my.
Oh my God. Not the smartest thing, but very smart.
That is terrible.
So like, I'm in treatment with these people. I'm young. I'm 20 years old. You know, people didn't go to treatment at 20 back then. It was like...
Right.
And so I went through detox, I went through treatment, and I started going to these NAH meetings. And for sure, I thought NA was going to be like a cult. They were going to make me shave my head, go door to door selling books or hand flowers out at the airport, chanting about God and all this stuff. And what I found was secretly, I felt better after I left a meeting. No matter what I was going through.
Wow.
Now, mind you, my first month or two out of treatment, and for the next 6 months, I worked for my father. I was his bitch. Now, my dad, to this day at 80 years old, still does manual labor. He owns a company with his brother that builds those big pallet racks see at Home Depot.
Yeah.
And
I have
back
a client
then,
who does that.
Okay. So back then it was pallet racks. It was cutting tables for the clothing industries.
He at 81 still does that stuff?
Still does it.
Good for him.
So I would get in the car with him in his little pickup truck at 5:30 in the morning, chain smoking cigarettes, listening to Caracol radio in Spanish on our way to Hialeah to his warehouse. I would work all day in hot warehouses in Miami with no air conditioning, eating my little lunch out of a bag. I'd come home every night at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd shower. I'd eat dinner. I'd go to a NAH meeting. I'd come home, and by 9 o'clock, I was sleeping. That sums up the first 6 months I was clean.
So you went past the 90 days.
I made it to the 90-day mark.
And what'd you think? What'd you say?
I looked in the mirror, and I looked better. I felt better. My relationships had improved.
Right.
And like a good addict, I said, if I feel this good at 90 days, I wonder how I'll feel at 6 months.
That's
and I
awesome.
Made it to 6 months. And at the 6 month mark, I said, you bet your ass I'm getting that year. at this point, I was involved in NA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I moved from the back of the room to the front of the room, had ocean view property like you have here, right?
Right.
And people started knowing my name. Now, back then, we would do go-arounds because the meetings were much smaller.
I go to still, the meetings I go to, we do go-arounds. I like to go to.
Now, I remember thinking as a kid, well, I call myself a kid back then, I can't wait till I get older and go to meetings because then everyone will be my age.
Mm.
Now I go to meetings and everybody's freaking younger.
I know, like, everyone's 19.
You can't win.
Which is so cool, actually,
it
because
is cool.
I don't know if at 19 I would have done any of this. But yeah, I mean, the age, there is no age to this, I feel like, you know?
Yeah, there's no age. So yes, and now here we are 28 plus years later, and I have not picked up a substance since June 19th, 1996.
That's incredible.
Now you hear people, Irina, you hear them share, you really have to want this to get it, and if you don't want it, don't worry about it because you won't get it. I call bullshit.
Right, I call bullshit on that too.
I didn't want it. I wasn't one of those people who was like, yes.
I didn't know what I wanted or didn't want. All I know is that I agreed at my intervention to go. I had no idea what I was in for. I had no idea what I or any of these things were. I didn't know I had to do work. And all throughout treatment, they're like, you have to do the work. I was like, can you guys just outline like what this work is? Like, I need, you know, some sort of like, I didn't get it. I couldn't understand, but I did it. I did what you did. I said, okay, I'll give it a year. I said a year. I'll give it a year, you know? And you're right. Like at 6 months, at, you know, certain like
milestones.
Thank you. At certain milestones, I was like, I feel better. And then I remember the day that I didn't think the first thing when I wake up was to go in the drawer to get my pills. And that was like when I was like, oh my God.
I'm doing it.
I'm doing this. And like, I feel better. I look better. I had gained a lot of weight, so I didn't feel like I looked that much better. But I did. In hindsight, it was way better than where I was. But anyway, it's so cool how we do that. We just, it gets better and better. Like, I'm now going to be at 8 years of recovery and like, I can't believe it. Like, I just feel so much better. I can't even imagine ever going back.
Well, you're not poisoning your body.
Right.
I mean, at the end of all of this, right? If I'm going to flash you back for a second, okay?
Yeah.
That Dr. Harris, and I'm going to tell you a pretty cool story. That Dr. Harris, whose office I was in that I did my intervention in, who was my psychologist starting at age 19. I continued to see him for the first couple years that I was in recovery. First, it was once a week, then it was once every 2 weeks, then maybe once a month. This went on for probably 3 or 4 years. Okay. And I remember in one of my early sessions with him, I probably had maybe 6 or 9 months clean. He said to me, he goes, Barry, if I invented a drug that you can do all day long and not have consequences, would you do it? And I was like, hell no, no way. Drugs are bad, okay? You know, like I was like, that NAH meetings brainwashed me. Like
oh,
I was
yeah.
like, no way. He goes, I'm telling you, if I invented a drug you can do, feel great and not have any consequences. You don't lose your job. You don't spend the money in your bank account. You wouldn't do it. And I thought about it for a second. And I said, well, hell yeah, I'd do it. He goes, of course you would.
Right.
Now, you might think this is crazy why I'm bringing this up, or the concept of getting clean and coming into recovery is not trying to convince a person that it doesn't feel good to get high or get drunk.
Right.
The concept is if you have the ability to get high and get drunk and not have consequences, continue doing it. But I, and I can only speak for me, would not be in the position I was in if I had that ability.
Exactly.
So coming to accept that I don't have the ability to successfully mm-hmm. moderate and get high and get drunk, I have a decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
It's all or nothing.
I'm the same, you know, and it's what I tell people. I'm like, you know, I know for me that it's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing.
And I can't speak for others, but for me, it's like that.
Cool story. This guy, Dr. Harris, I stopped seeing him. I think I was maybe 3 years clean, something like that. And I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. I left Gainesville after 2 years. I wound up re-enrolling at FAU, started studying psychology, was not 100% sure what I wanted to be. But I had started talking to Rick, Dr. Harris, about potentially becoming a psychologist. And my very last session with him, and on that day, I was his last session of the day, but this was my last session ever with him. Mm-hmm. He took me out the back way through like the employee exit because he had a lock up. Mm. And on the wall, he had these wooden mailbox slots with all people's names under each slot.
I remember those.
Remember those,
yeah.
Right? Inner office mail.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, Dr. Harris, I didn't realize you had so many psychologists working for you. He goes, yeah, maybe your name will be up there one day. And I was like, I shrugged it off. He and I lost touch. I wound up applying to a school in Miami for my doctorate in psychology, started school, went through 4 years of coursework, did a practicum, and it was come time to apply for my doctoral internship. So I applied in Chicago. I applied in California.
And you don't get paid when you do
for
these?
Internship, no. Typically right. Not.
Yeah.
I applied all over the country, and then I'm like, let me apply somewhere locally too. And they had this thing called the Consortium at Nova University. And so I applied there, and this is now 4 or 5 years later, right? I show up to my interview at Nova, and I walk in the room, and Dr. Harris is sitting there. And he goes, Barry? And I said, Dr. Harris? So he recused himself from the interview. He just didn't think it'd be appropriate.
Right.
The way the doctoral internship works, you rank where you want to go, and it's like a matching system.
Yeah.
I wind up matching at Nova, right. And that was where my
doctoral
internship.
And you don't think he had any?
I don't know. Yeah. To this day, it's a little suspect, but I was going to get placed somewhere, no matter what.
Yeah, okay? The others in the room were like, oh, well.
So I wind up matching at Nova, and once you complete your internship for a year, and I worked with like juvenile sex offenders, it was really interesting.
Wow.
So my degree was in forensic psychology. Mm-hmm. And I now have to do a year-long postdoc residency. And for your residency, you can do it anywhere. And I wound up doing my year-long postdoc residency at Dr. Harris's office, and my name made it up on the mailbox.
That's awesome. I love
that. How cool is that?
Yeah,
take
full circle.
Take it a step further, my dissertation that I had to do, which is before you could be called doctor, you have to do a dissertation. So it's either a study, a research study, or you can design a program. And now we're talking, this is 2008.
Okay.
I designed an intensive outpatient program using what was called evidence-based methodology. So something called neurobiofeedback, interactive journaling. He became my chairperson for this dissertation. And normally when you defend your dissertation, you're done. They call you doctor. You have this book you wrote and it goes up on a shelf and you go on with your life. Well, I defended my dissertation, became doctor, and we took this book and Dr. Harris and I took the program I wrote and we put it into existence. It became what was called the Center for Proven Recovery. And he and I became 50-50 business partners and opened this intensive outpatient program in Weston, Florida, out of his office. And that was the start of me working in the actual field of addiction treatment, which was probably around 2008.
Wow, amazing.
Later on, he became my partner in a residential treatment center we had together for about 5 years. It was... So, full circle, this person's office that I was in at the age of 19, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, became my business partner, which
That's
is
incredible.
Just like, it's a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
And he still has his little office in Weston. He's got an eating disorder, IOP. We're not as close anymore just because we've kind of gone our separate ways. Yeah. But
so tell me, you know, what does, so I know that you own a couple of treatment centers, Recovery Unplugged. You've done a recovery podcast, which, I mean, I listen to. You have extremely, like, extremely successful celebrities and artists on there, like Korn and so many others. And tell me more about, like, what, so early recovery, you told us it was, like, working hard, focus, disciplines, doing all of that. What does life look like in recovery? Like, what does your recovery look like now, 20 years later, 28, almost 30 years later?
Yeah. I'm not, and I'll put myself out there.
Yeah.
You know, I still sponsor guys. I still have a sponsor that I talk to regularly. I still pray every morning and every night. That's something that was instilled in me in my first year, you know, mm-hmm. that I came into NA.
Do you still do NA?
I still do NA. I don't do NA quite as much as I should.
Right. I do ah.
Honestly, yeah. to be honest, like ever since COVID, I feel like when everything went virtual.
Yes, me too. Ugh.
My meeting attendance has fallen off, right?
Yes.
I'm going to a meeting this Sunday at the park on Las Olas, you know, yeah. meeting some friends. I'm going to bring my kids.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah. So there's a park meeting there every Sunday night in Cooley Hammock Park, which... your significant other lives on Las Olas, so if you guys are around, it's a good meeting. But either way, you know, what does my life look like today? Busy. I am, you know, one of the VPs over at Recovery Unplugged Behavioral Health, mm-hmm. which is, in my opinion, the greatest treatment center in America.
Mm-hmm.
We use music as a catalyst to connect and engage with clients.
I love that. And you're wearing a shirt that says, "Nobody ever died from a music overdose," which I love.
It's true.
It is true.
And the coolest things about, I have all these different t-shirts with all these sayings that no matter where you go, somebody comments on it.
Yeah.
Like wear this shirt through an airport, you're going to get a minimum of 5 comments from 5 different people.
If you can make it in gray or white, since I have pugs,
we have it in white, yep.
I'll take one.
Okay, you got it.
Or I'll buy one. I mean, I'm not trying to get it for free, but like, you know, you could.
But you know, and they're conversation starters, and then you find out, well, my kid or my ex or my husband or my wife is struggling, right? There's so many people that struggle with what I would call substance misuse.
Right.
Right? We already know substance abuse is there, right? And then there's misuse. And so it really opens the door to people opening up to complete strangers, which mm-hmm. I feel like people are more comfortable opening up to strangers because, like, what do you have to lose kind of thing?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I can't tell you how many times
I felt. I just, yeah.
I've been in the airport or on an airplane, and within a week, that person is enrolled in our facility in one form or another.
That's awesome.
So it just happens. I've had it with valet drivers. I've had it with...
so like you... You know, part of being successful in sobriety or being clean, you know, whatever terminology you want to use, is helping others, right? Like the prayer, the meditation, all of those things, going to meetings, going to, you know, I do say on this podcast a lot that, like, I personally like a program, you know, that's what has worked for me. And I do recommend everyone at least trying it and giving it a fair shot, maybe doing steps or whatever. But I do know people who are successfully recovered that don't do a program. But I still think that there's these pillars that kind of work in every aspect, right? Like, and helping others is one of them. So helping others is a huge part of your life.
Yes. I mean, there's a four-word CNEI, constant, never-ending improvement,
yeah.
right? With constant, never-ending improvement, I'm always looking for ways to get better. There's always ways to excel. I was talking to one of my best friends, one of my sponsees, another friend of mine. We're going to be starting a private men's group out of the house.
Oh, cool.
That's going to meet every other Thursday before football We're going to get together. We're going to order some food in. We're going to shoot the shit for an hour or two, and then we're going to watch the game. It's really just about never staying too stuck for too long. It's okay to get stuck sometimes. It's okay to just be okay, right? I say that often. And it's also okay to not be okay, but just talk to someone about it.
Absolutely.
You don't want to get too stale. I kind of equate it to being on an escalator, okay? I'm sorry, not an escalator. Being on an escalator that's going down.
Or you got to constantly like,
and you got to constantly keep going, because if you stay stuck for too long, you run the risk of winding up back at the bottom again. So you always got to keep it moving. And it's okay if you stay stuck for a minute. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As long as you keep moving forward. And that's kind of the best way to put it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I do think that recovery ebbs and flows, you know, and that's normal. I mean, we are human, right? So like, just because you get sober, stop drinking, stop doing drugs, doesn't mean like, oh, life is perfect. You're never going to have any issues. You're always going to have money. And no, it's, you know, you still have to work. You still have issues. People in your life still get cancer. You know, like there's all this stuff that happens, and it's even better because you can deal with it sober. Like I can show up for my father today. I talk about that all the time. It's so cool. He has cancer. He's 86. And even though I don't live in New Jersey, which he would love me to, I was like, Dad, if I live up here, I'm going to be using. And then I won't see you anyway, you know, because I'll be out every night and I'll be not texting you back and not showing up and disappearing for weeks on end, you know. But I'd rather be sober and be able to come visit you every 2 months, you know, and see you not as often, but see you and spend time with
sure.
you and be with you, right? Like you're able to actually engage with society.
Yeah, recovery teaches you to be present. It teaches you to be selfless. It also teaches you to take care of yourself mm-hmm. at the same time, because like you said, if you don't take care of you, you're no good to anyone else. You know, this has been just a hell of a year. This past year has been one of the hardest and at the same time one of the most rewarding years I've had. I'm very lucky to have two beautiful girls in my life that are 12 and 10. Mm-hmm. I have an ex-wife that I'm very amicable with. We're great co-parents.
Thank God.
I have a beautiful fiance who's got two boys that are 7 and 8. And we've.
I remember you told me when you were going to get engaged. Like yep. You were going to propose.
Yep. And we blended a family. And on November 11th of last year, her then 7-year-old, now 8-year-old son was diagnosed with leukemia. And this has been one of the most difficult journeys that we've embarked on as a new unit, right? It would be hard for anybody. Right. But, you know, watching a 7-year-old with cancer and the type he had, which was an aggressive, rare, he has like a rare chromosome that made it much more difficult to treat, and watching the stages of everything that we've gone through from November 11th to present day and where we're at has really been a remarkable journey.
Thank God.
So, you know, it's without recovery. Like she said to me, her name is Francie. She said to me the other day, she just looked right at me and she said, I'm so glad you're in recovery. We're sitting in the car. Yeah. She said, I'm so glad you're in recovery. And I just kind of head nodded, like, but I felt it, because had I not been,
right,
A, I wouldn't even be in the position that I'm in. But
right, of course.
To be able to be present and to be there for him and her, right? And at the same, try to balance being there for my daughters that I have 50% of the time,
yeah,
being there for Recovery Unplugged, which I'm heavily invested into, mm-hmm. And helping others at the same time, the more I help others, the better I feel about myself. And so he's doing great now. You know, he had a bone marrow transplant. Yeah. They are still in Miami and will be for the next couple months. He has to remain close to the hospital. His numbers have skyrocketed. Knock on all kinds of wood. Everything is really good with him. But I've never dealt with anything like this.
Yeah, that's scary. Thank God you have the means. I was saying earlier, like, thank God you have the means to stay close to the hospital. Thank God you have the means to get him the care. I'm sure that he's at probably a great hospital and everything.
Yeah, he's at Nicholas Children's. So, you know, but he did most of his treatment at Joe DiMaggio's in Hollywood, but they're just not a transplant hospital. So he checked into Nicholas on June 3rd and was there for 49 days, got out 2 Mondays ago, and then has another 2 months in my... Oh, this has been like... We're at the tail end of this journey. So, but either way, like without recovery, without a support system, without my friends, my family, you know, we would not have been able to do this.
I'm sorry you're going through that, but it sounds like he's doing well. So I'm happy to hear that. So tell me, is there anything you feel like you haven't told us that you think you should or want to?
Is there anything I feel like I had? You're talking to a guy who could talk for 6 hours.
I can talk for 6 hours.
Okay.
Too. So I did that with one of Michael Herbert, who maybe you know him. Just
I know the name.
Yeah. He was on here and our podcast went 1 hour and 40 minutes. Yeah. And we hung out for like 3 hours.
I could talk. I could tell you like, what does my life look like today? I'm a partner at a unbelievable treatment program. Yeah. That really helps people.
That's so cool. I mean, I know the place. I've spoken at meetings at Recovery Unplugged, and I think it was in Lake Worth, right?
That's our detox and res.
Yep. That's where I spoke, and I think it's such a cool program. I knew a girl whose name I can't really remember right now, who worked there, who said it was a great place. So that's so cool. I love knowing people from all different treatment places because people call me for help all the time and I, you know, try to pair them with the right, you know, spot. So it's really good to know that.
Yeah. We've just taken on this new venture where we've veered into the behavioral health space. So it's not just substance use, but we just opened a 40-bed primary mental health residential program. That's just beyond gorgeous.
Amazing.
And, you know,
mental health is something that it's a big topic now. People are actually talking about it. And, you know, that's great because in the end of the day, if we don't handle the mental health aspect, we're going to, or maybe not everyone, but a lot of people will eventually either lots of people kill themselves or they'll throw themselves into a horrible coping mechanism.
Well, yeah. Think about addiction and mental illness, right? 85% to 90% is all co-occurring.
Yeah.
Right? It gets to a point, and I can only speak for myself, I got to a place in active addiction where it was really about self-medicating.
Yeah, me too.
Right? I think most people reach that spot where it's about self-medicating.
So the last question I have for you is, if you can go back and tell your younger self, you could choose the age, what age would it be and what would you tell that self?
That is such a tough question because I've thought of this before.
Yeah.
Right? Do I tell myself never to pick up a substance?
No.
I don't know what my life would look like today or where I'd be.
Right.
You know, I'm a believer that we go through whatever we go through to get to wherever we've gotten to, and there are no mistakes along the way. That everything we did or chose not to do led us to where we are.
Yeah.
I'm ecstatic, for the most part, about where I'm at today. Are there some things, some life choices I've made in the past that I wish I didn't make? The answer to that is a resounding yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really, and I'm going to take the easy way out here, I don't fucking know what I would say.
Okay, that's fine.
I don't know what I would tell myself other than there's a few things you did, even in adulthood.
Right.
Just don't fucking do those things. Okay? Just like veer off at that spot. Control yourself and not do it. But overall, like, I think I'm okay with where I'm at.
Well, that's, I'm so happy to hear that. And thank you so much for coming. And I really appreciate you being here. I hope you had fun.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I did.
Okay. And the last thing we do is hug.
Okay.
Okay.